It's Wednesday, May 8th, 2024, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me, as always, are my colleagues Kathy Kiley and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, a look at this year's Pulitzer Prizes and the one thing that each and every honoree had in common. TikTok's owner has filed suit in federal court, stopping the clock on the sell or be banned bill President Biden signed into law last week. And after 3 years as president of ABC News, the first Black woman to lead a network news division announces her retirement from broadcast journalism. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to before our half hour is up today, but we're going to start this week where we left off our last program, talking about the grim reports we expected and did receive last Friday, World Press Freedom Day. Reporters Without Borders released its annual press freedom rankings, and the United States dropped a whopping 10 spots from this time last year to 55. That's 55 out of 180 countries. Now, the U.S. has bounced back and forth in the mid-40s for the past 5-6 years. I don't think it's been higher than 40s since 2013. Is this because things are worse here than they were a year ago? Or is it that things in other countries are improving? I mean, I look at this too, and I think about someplace you have visited recently, Niger. We are closer to Niger, ranked at 80, than we are Canada, ranked at 14.
Yeah, it's pretty depressing. I think there may be a little bit of thumb on the scale there. I think the situation, the United States is viewed as the gold standard, really. I mean, because we have a First Amendment, for a long time we've been a leader in setting the standards by which other people were supposed to operate when it comes to free press. So I think when there is backsliding in the United States, there's probably more of a reaction than there would be if it were in another country. And I think, you know, if you wonder why we've fallen, you need only think about, we could just do reruns of this show and talk about things that we've discussed, the raid on the newspaper at Marion, reporters under attack, people being threatened with jail. I mean, the leading candidate for one of our major political parties has said multiple times, and of course I'm talking about Donald Trump, that journalists should be put in jail. This guy could be president next year. And I think people who are monitoring this stuff across the world are taking note.
I also think misinformation and disinformation has a lot to do with it. And the fact that over and over again, we've talked about it, but nothing really has been done in terms of nothing substantial has been done to actually deal with that. I mean, it's almost like, you know, we're trying to put a Band-Aid on a wound that really needs to have major surgery. No. And that, I think, contributes to our standing as it relates to freedom of information, as it relates to freedom of the press, and all these other issues that we were once known as. We basically set the mark for that. And now, you know, because of all these things, we're not.
Yeah, one of the other criteria that Reporters Without Borders, which issues the index, uses is financial support for journalism. And there are some movements to change that, which we're going to talk about. But I think that, too, could be a criterion that there are so many newspapers, news organizations folding and under intense financial pressure in this country.
Or the business models have changed or adapted so that is leading to some of that problem.
But I think the other issue here also is that we in this country don't look at news the same way. Mm-hmm. And I think that has that reflects back on that as well. I mean, and how people actually get their news and what news are they actually consuming also contributes to that sort of culture of that's different from what the rankings and what they're looking at.
Yeah, certainly most journalists' relationship with their sources are very different than they used to be. It's much harder to get people to talk. And I think that a lot of that has to do with the reputational damage that's been done partly by political actors who don't want press scrutiny, damaging the press, you know, calling credibility into question, And partly by what you're talking about, Ernest, with social media, you know, when people think about media in this country, they don't distinguish between crazy cousin Vinny's Facebook post.
They don't. Yeah, and that's a challenge I have with a lot of the students who I work with who are not journalism majors. When I ask them to reflect on their news and information consumption, that they aren't able to distinguish between social media and traditional journalism, that they can find on other platforms outside of social media. They see them as one and the same.
Right.
The owners of TikTok have filed a lawsuit in U.S. appeals court. They did that yesterday, saying that the law that President Biden signed last month requiring ByteDance to either divest or face permanent ban in the U.S. is an unprecedented violation of the First Amendment and is thus unconstitutional. And the point they're trying to make here is that Congress, who according to First Amendment shall make no law, has passed a law that targets a single named platform that is in use as part of the public square by more than a million Americans.
Well, I mean, this is going to be settled in court. And really the question boils down to, is TikTok considered a part of the press and thus is covered by the First Amendment and the Constitution? Or is it a company, a media company, that is seen as a national security threat by Congress and the president?
And if they are considered a part of the press that's covered by the First Amendment, they're also covered by libel law.
That's right.
And that is where I think, you know, the platforms can't have it both ways. They don't want to be considered publishers when it comes to libel law, which is why there's so much trash out there. But they do want to be considered publishers when it comes to the First Amendment. So, I mean, this is a real, it will be settled in court, but part of the settlement is going to be determining just what these platforms are.
Now, one of the things about this suit, it was fully expected that it was going to come. More than anything, this is a stalling measure, because what it does is it immediately stops the clock on any potential ban that would be enforced by the law. It really is adding, because of the way the court system works, potentially years before
right.
any real action can be taken.
Right. I mean, and basically what it does is it throws the entire thing into court. It's like, okay, we're going to have to settle this, and we're going to have to settle it in court and stop dancing around again.
Bite
going back
dance.
To the
yes, I see what you did there.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know that you meant
bite dancing around
and TikTok
bite,
dancing
that's right,
around.
Yeah,
yeah, it's,
yeah,
I saw what you did there. How might some of the cases that we're waiting on that are going to come out in the next month or so that the court heard this year perhaps create precedent or speak to this case as well?
Which ones are you talking
about? The Texas and Florida cases that the Supreme Court
I think, this is all going to be part of a whole trying to decide how much control the government can have over social media. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, there's a big difference here, which is your local newspaper and, until pretty recently, your local TV station or your radio station can't reach in and grab data about you. I mean, there's the Nielsen's, but that isn't even you.
But that's a voluntary thing, too.
That's a voluntary
thing.
So the difference here, and I think what policymakers and lawmakers are concerned about, is what the scholar Shoshana Zuboff calls surveillance capitalism, which is with digital platforms, data about the users is being extracted. So in the Florida case, you have people who were worried about minors. This is going to be very hard to stop. But I think ultimately the courts and policymakers, lawmakers have to make a decision. Are these utilities?
Right.
And therefore need to be regulated like utilities are by government. Are they publishing platforms? And therefore, it's going to be full employment for our students, because they're going to have to hire actual human editors mm-hmm. to ferret out the libel and the slander and all of the rest of the stuff that is out there. So, I mean, I don't think one court decision is going to do this whole... I've told my students, this is going to be a debate for their generation, and this is going to go on. We're seeing the EU talk about it. We're seeing the Supreme Court. You know, last term, the court talked about Google and Twitter, and could they be held liable for deaths that occurred because of propaganda that was spread right. on their platforms. The court decided in favor of the tech companies in that one, but I just think the tech companies are going to find themselves under increasing scrutiny by both the courts and policymakers.
Okay. So, you know, there are some things to celebrate in the world of journalism. Monday was Pulitzer Day. And as Report for America founder Stephen Waldman noted, I missed taking a URL out there. Sorry about that. Right. Of the 11 outlets that won journalism Pulitzers, none were owned by hedge funds. Zero were owned by private equity. Two in publicly traded companies. Four were nonprofit. Five were family owned. So who were they? Well, the Washington Post walked away with three, so did the New York Times. Even more exciting, the honors for coverage of local news issues. Another of the organizations to take home multiple honors, a little-known group out of Chicago called the Invisible Institute. Who is this group? What do they do?
I love this story. Yeah, they are a startup. They cover really gritty issues about, I think the one that won a prize was about a podcast that looked at a long ago, I think in 1990s, death of a young boy and how that had affected the neighborhood. So they are really doing very deep dives. The reporters they hire are interesting. They're atypical. And, you know, I just think every year the Pulitzer will hold up some small organization that's punching above its weight. And this was, I honestly had never heard of them until the Pulitzer was awarded. So good for the Pulitzer Committee for highlighting some of this work.
Right.
Not one, but two there. Ernest, one of our doctoral candidates, Lisa Krantz, was on one of the teams, too. This is very exciting for us and for your graduate program as well.
This is very exciting. I mean, Lisa, we recruited Lisa to our doctoral program several years ago. She's finishing up next month her doctoral program. She's going to be taking a position at the, if I'm giving it correctly, University of Montana. She was on the Washington Post team that did the story on the use of the AR-15 in most of the mass shootings.
Magnificent piece.
Their approach to that was definitely worth a Pulitzer and more. So if you haven't read that, I highly recommend you go back and read that. But Lisa in particular was a freelance photographer who did some photojournalism work in Sulphur Springs, Texas, in the Sutherland Church there, which had been victims of a mass shooting. She had covered that story originally as a photojournalist for the San Antonio Express News. And so they asked her to come back. The Washington Post did ask her to come back and work with that. And this is also a part of her research.
Right. Talk a little bit more about that, too.
She really looks at what is the relationship between journalists and the victims of mass shootings and the trauma that not only the victims are going through, but also how that impacts journalists both while they're covering it and afterwards. And so in a way, she's trying to come up with best practices on how journalists can actually cover these events when they happen. And I think it's something that the field itself can really benefit from. And that was one of the things that we in the graduate program really wanted her to come here and do. And because of that, we have others who are looking at that, also looking at the journalism school as a way to come in and do research around trauma and how that impacts both the people who are being covered and the journalists who are covering them.
She's having quite a month picking up her velvet doctor's cap and her Pulitzer.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny. I think back to 2013, because Lisa is not the first graduate student to pick up a Pulitzer while still here and in our program. I think about
right.
Charles Minshew,
right.
who also, for work he had done at the Denver Post while he was a master's student, I remember looking at him on Pulitzer Day and be like, dude, he was working on his thesis. And I said, dude, it's all downhill from here. what you do as we talk in jest, I do want to kind of bring it back to a really serious point, though, and you talk about trauma. And one of the acknowledgments, the honors this year went to Reuters for its photographic coverage of the Israel and Hamas war. And I want to talk about that for a second and just war coverage in general, because it came up a lot last year and the year before as well with coverage from Ukraine, a lot of which is very violent, is very gory, and is very painful for a lot of people. And it can be hard for people to see that work awarded, that word is kind of touchy around that. At the same time, it's really important work, and that this is what documents and changes history.
No, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that there's been criticism of journalism in the past for not showing those photos, for not really showing what war really is, and in some ways glorifying it in ways that just shouldn't happen. So now that we've decided that, you know, we're going to move in a direction to show people exactly what war means, not only on the battlefield, but also what does it mean in the communities that are being bombed and in those instances, this is important. But then we award it, and that becomes sort of an issue of, okay, are you glorifying the reporters and the photojournalists who are actually out there covering it? They're not out there covering it to win awards. They are out there covering it to actually show people this is the reality when we decide that we want to go to war.
I think that's one of the reasons, too, that I'm trying to use words like honor or recognize instead of award, because award does kind of carry with it that idea of the gold medal.
Right.
Well, I think it's important, as Ernest is pointing out, not to confuse the journalism. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're not there as fans, mm-hmm. right? We're there as witnesses. And what journalists witness, particularly in a war zone, I think it's important for people to know. It's important for people to know what war looks like and the terrible damage that's done. And maybe we'll think about getting involved in a war a few times before we do that. So I think it's hard, I think, for people who aren't part of the profession to see that distinction. I mean, just because you write about what a politician says doesn't mean you agree with that person.
Right.
It means that you are reporting what this elected official says so that people can make intelligent mm-hmm. decisions. It's the same thing for the photographers. They're taking a picture of what's in front of them. And it's not meant to glorify, it's meant to witness.
And it's the same as if you're out on the battlefield or you're in these cities that are being bombed. It's the same thing that Lisa was trying to do in her coverage of mass shootings. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we're not there doing that kind of coverage, then people don't, you know, people won't really understand the damage that's being done here, and what are the ramifications across communities.
Okay. The first black woman to head a network news division told her staff Sunday night that she is retiring from broadcast journalism. Kim Godwin has been at the helm of ABC News for 3 years, coming over from CBS. And it's been a little bit of a rocky time there, but her tenure has led to some marked changes on the network's news division's culture. And these are the types of things that maybe some of the coverage we've seen this week of her departure hasn't quite gotten to, about how she managed and maneuvered the removal of Amy Rohrbach and T.J. Holmes from Good Morning America, or about the dismissal of a very high-level producer who had been accused of sexual harassment. And NABJ, the National Association of Black Journalists, has issued a statement calling out a lot of the national media who were covering her in the past few weeks for providing what is truly a one-sided look as to what was going on there, really only looking at those who were the dissenting voices in her situation.
Yeah, there's that coverage was there. It talked a lot about all of the things that happened during her tenure that were negative, but needed to be done. I mean, she went in and she basically was told, we need to change the culture. And whenever you're going into an organization, any organization, and culture change is needed, it's going to be rocky. It's going to be messy. And that's pretty much, you know, the situation that she was in. I mean, the New York Times had that same situation previously when they mm-hmm. made changes. I mean, and the Washington Post recently went through that when they went in and they did a whole bunch of layoffs and people left and that sort of thing. And the LA Times is still struggling with that. So whenever you have those kinds of changes, you're going to have these problems. The issue for Kim Godwin and for ABC is that they made the decision, we're going to make a change at the top, and hopefully that will calm things down. We'll see. A lot of it is going to be dependent on who comes in and what is going to be the mandate for that person based on the people who hired him or her.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to use an earnestism and say, and we're surprised. I mean, we're surprised because all too often, trailblazers, mm-hmm. whether it be a person of color, a female.
Mm-hmm. A female person of color.
And, yeah. Yes. And so she checks two of those boxes. Get to head these organizations when they're in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, when mm-hmm. they're fat and happy and making $1 zillion profit, then the usual suspects will take care of that. Then you put somebody in, as Kevin Merida was.
And, yes.
You
know,
at the LA Times.
It's like saying, here, the house is on fire. Here's a little watering can. Good luck with that. And so, I mean, should we be surprised? And I think when you look at what happened, they put somebody over her. Why would you stay?
Right.
I mean, you know, who needs that? So right. I just think
They brought back the old guard in mm-hmm. terms of Michael Eisner. I mean, mm-hmm. who's coming back in? Roger Inger, who's coming back right. in at Disney, and so you've got all of that going on, and again, I mean, it's almost like you're setting this person up to do the impossible.
Yeah. Yeah, and then when they can't get it done, they get blamed.
Okay, so meanwhile in Dallas, management at the Dallas Morning News announced the addition of a public editor to its staff this week. The role of ombudsman, an editor providing oversight to the newsroom, is one that has almost all but died out in the past decade. According to the Poynter Institute, it's believed that NPR might be the only national organization that still has a public editor, Kelly McBride. But the Dallas Morning News decided it's time to add one back, and Steve Buckley is the guy. Now, Ernest Buckley is a professor of practice at Duke, a former dean at Poynter, and the Dallas Morning News says that bringing him in is going to help to reestablish trust, which I know is something that you've got some thoughts on.
Well, you know how I feel about that.
Yeah,
you know,
yes, we all do. Yeah. There is none, and there hasn't been for decades and decades and decades.
The question becomes, does he come in and build relationships, mm-hmm. you know, which is something that local news media organizations need to be working on, is building relationships with the communities that you're covering and telling their story from their lived experience. And how does this public editor fit into that role? I mean, is he going to be the public editor for the public, or is he going to be the public editor for the Dallas Morning News? That's a huge difference in terms of being able to build a relationship and thus having some form of trust, if you want to call it that.
One of the things that I also find curious and is maybe a model to watch, and I don't even know if model is the word, he's still going to be teaching at Duke. So the geography doesn't entirely add up for me there.
Well, it's going to be kind of hard to build a relationship with the community in Dallas when you're living in North Carolina. That's going to be a huge problem there.
Yeah, it does suggest that there's a little, it's not a full investment, either by the paper or by the new ombudsman. I think you need to be there. You're absolutely right. If you're going to build a relationship with a community, you need to be there. Boots on the ground.
Okay, so we have had a little bit of a theme this week, the fight for local news. And that fight keeps going strong. In the states of New York and California, there's currently legislation and efforts that are going through the system which aim to support and beef up local news coverage. Kathy, tell us quickly a little bit about each of these and the likelihood of what they can accomplish.
Well, they're very different models, but they're both trying to pump money into local publishers, especially small publishers like the ones that Steve Waldman likes.
Steve Waldman, two call-outs today.
Yeah. Go ahead. But the California bill, it's interesting to see the controversy on that, because it would tax the big internet providers. It would basically create a link tax. And oh my, the knickers are in a twist because it's California, the land of Silicon Valley, and a lot of local publications get money from Google.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all kinds of gyrations going on. I don't know. That'll be interesting to see what happens. The New York law seems, which would provide a tax credit for hiring reporters, seems to have a more easy path. And we'll see what happens. It's an interesting idea.
Okay. Well, before we go, Kathy, Ernest, and I have some news to share with you. After today's show, the three of us will be stepping away from Views of the News. It has been a wild ride. It's been just shy of 11 years for Ernest and me, and five since Kathy joined us. And we are all going to miss our weekly chats about what's going on in the media world. I want to take a minute and acknowledge all of the folks who have made this show what it has been going back for decades. First, a nod to our late colleague, Rod Gillette, who debuted this show on KBIA nearly 30 years ago. He turned it over to our former colleague, Mike McKean, and to regular panelists, Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis, who Ernest and I took over for back in 2013. Behind the scenes, we owe a very special thanks to our audio operators, Takia Thomas and Aaron Hay and Pat Akers before her. Tim Pilcher has composed our most recent theme music, and Nate Brown has dutifully been our social media manager for the past few years. And directing this show since its move to the Reynolds Journalism Institute 15 years ago, Travis McMillan. Some other folks we owe a thank you to for sure, Mike Dunn and Kyle Felling at KBIA, to Dean David Kirpius for his support all these years, and Dean Mills before him, and Randy Picht at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. And I want to personally just take a minute or so to thank the two of you for what has been an amazing run, sitting down every week talking about topics, some of them very tough, every once in a while bringing the laughs. Ernest, you and I have inside jokes I don't even know if you realize are inside jokes. But it has been such a pleasure and an honor to be here with both of you.
Well, thanks to you, Amy, for doing such a great job of hosting this, and all the work that goes into researching this show, putting together the links blog every week, and keeping the conversation going. It's been fun, and I just think we should have lunch and do this without microphones.
I would agree. I agree with Kathy. I mean, it has been a pleasure. I mean, you and I have been here for quite a while. I didn't realize it was 11 years.
We started doing this in August of 2013.
Yeah, it's been a wild ride. I remember when Charles Davis asked mm-hmm. me, "Hey, we need somebody to take over this," and I came on and did a couple of shows before being on here permanently, and it has been. It has been enjoyable. I mean, I think if we lasted through several presidencies.
Right? And, I mean, I was thinking about that. We've been doing this through the Obama presidency, the Trump presidency, the Biden presidency.
Yeah, it's been a minute. It's been a minute. Yeah. And there's been a lot, but there's like you said, there's been a lot of good too. I mean, you weren't even watching Star Wars before.
Right? You got me to watch Star Wars.
Or the Marvel movies.
The Marvel movies, which by the way, there was news about those this week. And I even think about how we learned even so much about our first seven jobs before journalism.
That's
so
right.
Lots of memories there. Well, that music does mean we are out of time. So thank you for spending your last half hour with us. Thank you for spending the last 30 years with us. Our archive will remain online on KBIA.org, Facebook, and YouTube. You can also download past episodes wherever you get your podcast downloads, including iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. I'm Amy Simons, and for Kathy Kiley, Ernest Perry, and the whole team, thank you.